Baseball season starts just like everybody else. No, this isn't Singing Sadie, Tim. Let me. This is The Intruders with Love is Like a Baseball Game. See, I like having this primitive BS, non-professional opening. It makes it seem like everything's above board and honest and all that, even
yeah,
though.
Yeah, we're just guys sitting around talking about something, you know, a thing, which is kind of true, yeah, right?
Yeah, okay, so here's the, here's everybody's Plan 9 Radio Mysterioso intro. Someday.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
How long is it going to take me to not be lazy and make up a new... Wow, somebody really turned down the bass there. Do they want to make themselves sound like a total wuss without all this bass in their voice? Here's that. Let's see, that's much better. It's Radio Mysterioso here for the 20th of January, 2013. We made it through the millennium, whatever it is. We've talked about that already. However, let me turn that down so I can hook Tim into the thing here. And you will hear him breathing now as I hook it in here.
I'm not asking you who's that second.
Who is on first?
Wow, what's, where's
know.
That coming from? There's synchronicity, because I was just playing that Love is Like a Baseball Game, and here's who's on first.
I just thought I...
Playing on some other input to the board here. Amazing. Okay, that's what this show's like. There's Tim. I've got him turned up.
I'm just chuckling quietly until...
Yeah, well, you don't have to chuckle quietly. You can chuckle out loud now. Because
chuckle
we're
loudly?
On, yes, because we're on the air. This is, I've had, Tim has been on the show before, mainly just, I think we were talking about Jim Moseley. Let's do the approved intro. Tim's a retired co-editor of Saucer Samir, which we'll talk about. Assistant professor of psychology at Georgia Perimeter College. Is that right?
That's correct. Close enough. Or actually you are right, but yeah. Sounds better to just say close enough.
Okay. Close enough. Fan of old school UFO strangers, just like we are. And I think he's been listening for a while. There's a couple times before we've talked about Moseley here, and so we'll talk about him again tonight. Some of Jim's off-the-record stuff, and find out what makes Tim here excited as I get more and more apparently bored with the UFO subject. But I advertise that we're going to be talking about UFO stuff, so that's what we'll do. Hi, Tim.
Hello. How are you, Greg?
Pretty good.
As good as you were just a moment ago, I'm assuming, but hopefully, right?
The what's a moment ago?
I said, hopefully you're doing well, although I just asked you that when we actually started speaking before the conversation.
I'm still doing fine right now. Yeah. I'm still doing the show. I mean, that's something. There's been a horrible dearth of new shows in the last couple of months. In fact, people started writing me and saying, are you stopping doing the show, or what's going on. It's just that I've been very lazy about the show and busy with other stuff. So, and now things seem to be falling into place.
I think there's also that expectation in podcasting that you know everyone has has a podcast it for 5 seconds or so, and then you've been persistent. At least we can give it that. Right? Yeah. You've been doing this for how long though? This show particularly.
You're already cutting out on Skype. It's wonderful. I've been doing the show as Radio Misterioso since I think like 2002 or three, on Kill Radio since 2000. And before that, there was another show called The Hungry Ghost on a pirate FM station here in LA.
I was on The Hungry Ghost with you.
Yeah, you were. I wish I could find that. Yeah, I got to look through tapes.
One of us might have a tape somewhere, right?
That'd be great if I could find the tape. Oh, wow. Because I've just found the barest. Like, I found one with Scott Corrales. I think that's the only one I found from those years. There might be another one in there. I've got one from Ira Einhorn, but people keep asking me to post that again, which I will. That was actually great, from Kill Radio. So, how did we first get in contact? I don't even remember. I mean, if we talked back in Hungry Ghost days...
I think it was Miles Lewis that put us in touch, and I know you had written into Saucer Smear a few times, and I saw The Excluded Middle, of course, in those days, and I think Smiles introduced us, though, sometime around the I don't know if the Kookouts passed and the National UFO Convention of 2001, that didn't happen, but I think that's somewhere around there we got vaguely interconnected, we at least had 28.8 modems or something, right? I recall.
Yeah.
It was sending around, paper zines and stuff.
Yeah. And I was able to do interviews by email in the mid to late 90s. So I guess something was working then.
Ira Einhorn was, where was he? He was overseas and
he was in France.
Right.
He was holed up in France.
Yeah, that would be a good one to dig up. Yeah, definitely.
Well, I've still got it. It's just that I've never really posted it. I guess I should. I mean, there's people asking about it. And for a while, he was writing me, and I actually sent him like $200 worth of books. And you can't buy used books for inmates. This is when he was already in prison. You can't buy used books for inmates. So I had to go and buy them all new, which is why it costs so damn much.
Is what the worry that like you're gonna have some kind of cryptography built into the used books or what? I mean,
I don't know what it is. I mean, you could do it with a new book too. I don't know what the thinking is behind it. But
not much. But
he tried to act with me like I was a confidant and he was being really cool with me and I was lucky to have him talking to me and all this. And I got tired of it, so I just sent him that one shipment of books and then I stopped communicating with him.
Yeah, you're lucky to be able to send him hundreds of dollars of books at your expense, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I was just trying to help him out because, he's a horrible murderer. Well, I think he probably is a murderer, but he'd done the interview with the magazine, and he'd been pretty open about that. And I'd sent him, I didn't have any pictures of him, so I sent him a roll of film, black and white film. He had his wife or somebody take pictures of him. Around his
while he's in jail, by the way, or prison.
No, this was before he got extradited. So they took pictures. I said, "Could you please take a picture of one of the magazines?" And he actually did. He took a picture of himself reading an Excluded Middle. So I put
I remember that. That's right. All right.
So I put that in the magazine, and then he was under house arrest. Or he had to like show up every week somewhere in France to make sure he wasn't on the run. And then he got extradited back here, got put on trial.
I'm not versed in the Iron literature history, but there are other connections there with Polanski and others, Manson. And isn't that part of the background of the Iron story?
Yeah, well, if there is, I don't remember. His background was kind of like being a hippie activist guy. And after that, he was before that, actually, he was... putting people, he was kind of like a counterculture fixer guy, and he put people together and get people communicating. And he had a photocopied newsletter, not really newsletter, but just a bunch of like cutting edge information he'd send around to a small group of people, like I think Puharik and Yuri Geller and and maybe even Valet and people like that. But that ended when he suddenly skipped out of the country when he was being hunted down.
Yeah, being charged with murder will hamper on your zine career, you know.
Huh?
I said being charged with murder will put a hamper on your zine career, you know, your publishing career, kind of.
But you had
to send a film. That's what's funny to me. Like, you can't buy a film even over.
Well, but we couldn't send pictures through email at that point, or didn't know how to do it.
But you had to send him the film. Like, he couldn't buy his own film.
Well, I guess I was just trying to be nice. But the thing was, I sent him the film, and I also sent him a copy of his only book he ever published. And I found it online somewhere, like eBay or something, and I had him sign it.
And all right, nice.
So that came back with an inscription, and then, you know, we did the interview, and then after that he was in jail, and he went on trial. And so anyway, that was the Ira Einhorn saga. And if you I'll put the interview up, because if you listen to the interview, I keep asking him about the murder, and he keeps changing the subject, and you can hear me at one point throw the phone across the room while he's talking.
Yeah, I guess. There's a little to be gained from discussing the murder on air, you know.
After a while, I realized he wasn't going to say anything, so I just kind of...
Yeah. By the way, I did it click, you know, see, you know, nanny nanny boo boo, I'm already in France, or I don't know. But, yeah, so that was around the era, I guess, that we started talking, but...
Yeah. And then...
Many moons ago.
Yeah, I put up online on Facebook, I said people could call in if they wanted to talk about Jim Moseley a little bit, probably in about 20 minutes from now, for about half an hour, because if I say people can call in through the whole show, I'm just going to be ignoring the phone the whole time. So maybe we should talk a bit about Jim. We actually, when we did talk about him last week, and I think... I don't know if we've talked about this on air yet, about how you met him and how long you knew Jim Moseley and how he became basically a friend and a mentor and all that.
Yeah, I think maybe I gave the briefest version possible. But, yeah, we met when I was, I guess, 14 or so. I had the, the luck or coincidence or whatever you want to call it, misfortune or whatnot of growing up near or in Gulf Breeze at the time of the Ed Walters UFO case, whatever you want to call it. And of course there were conferences, UFO conferences and everything. I could actually literally see Ed Walters' house from like my place, and he was you'd see Kainch on ABC News with we didn't have much news back then, I guess, if Ed Walters' UFOs were the lead story on the nightly news. It was, a slow news week. But, so that was Jim, of course, smoking a cigarette somewhere, having a drink. And Linda Cortil, I recall, or Linda Napolitano, was cursing at him for revealing her last name or something, I think it was. And, we kept in touch over the years. I mean, through phases, we always at least talked once a month, but, sometimes once a week. And he was kind of my adopted uncle, in fringeology or weird, approaches to weirdness. One of the only people that I think we had discussed at one point, the idea that it'll, and like, the realization at some point that there is one, there can be an approach that's not some dogmatic kind of, this is the answer and all that. And Jim was the first person that I met, that showed me that was not only, an intellectually a way to go, but it was also, it's kind of a cool way to go, like, hey, I'm not buying all this stuff, man. Let me see what's happening here,
Yeah.
And of course, Jim being just as much interested in the people, if not more so, I guess, I shouldn't say that, equally interested in the people as the phenomenon, but of course the people are in part the phenomenon. So
I had Tim Beckley on once, and if you let him go, he will go for half an hour. That was fine with me, because everything he said was interesting, so I let him go for half an hour at a clip.
Back the old timers, man. No offense meant by that. The classics, I guess we should say, right?
Well,
few of them remaining, and
Yeah, well, Tim's one.
Alan Greenfeld and those guys.
Didn't Tim work with Jim Moseley, too, at an early stage?
Tim Beckley?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. There's apparently like this, you know, this when Jim had the money, he always, you know, had someone helping him, you know, at the highest point of circulation. I think he had like, thousands of, you know, a couple thousand readers at the height of his publication, you know, and he and Gray Barker had a little office, you know, and had employed a kid who would work for $1 an hour or whatever, you know, and mail out the zine and so forth. And I guess Beckley, I think, and what Steinberg was a similar, you know.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, similar, well, never mind. I'll leave that where it is. But yeah, you know, so. But yeah, you know, Jim was always such a character, man, you know, so much fun, you know, but yet still the most full of shit guy, but also not because he admits it, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, Gonzo Drone, I could say in a sense, right?
Yeah.
Saucer. Yeah, and like I say, we kept in touch for a long time, and eventually he put me on the masthead as contributing editor, which was, I guess, a personal gesture more than anything. I can't say I reviewed much science that came through the doors of the Saucer's Mirror office, but, you know, hey, it was a great ride, man. And, well, we met, you know, when I met Jim, you know, I remember saying something along the lines of, you know, why you keep drinking like that, you're going to wake up next to your liver. And, you know, he laughed and, oh, I've been doing this for a long, long time, and I'll continue to, or something along those lines. And he did exactly that, so.
Well, he was, you know, he seemed fine with it, and he didn't really, I think I only talked to him a couple times when he was really overcome by the drinking. And at that point, he was even funnier than normal and kept it together. You know, a lot of people get drunk and, you know, they don't make any sense. He made perfect sense.
Oh, yeah.
So he,
or at least give the appearance of, you know, like, whichever was, or is it the same thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, perfect sense and even funnier than normal. And, you know, just like anybody drunk, he started really telling you what he thought. The thing is that he sort of pretty much told you what he thought anyway in the zine, but he was vaguely nice about it. He wasn't a mean person.
No, you know, I don't know who, maybe it was you, but, you know, the fact that he was actually often friends with people that he really even just thought were full of shit, you know, in regards to their stories sometimes, like Ed Walters, you know, he, you know, always cordially, hey, hi, Ed, hi, you know, still selling your UFO book, or, you know, you're full of crap, by the way, but, you know, and Ed Walters was cool with that. He had no, you know, issue with it, which, you know, maybe it makes me think slightly even more so that he was full of crap, but, you know, that's a different issue. but yeah, Jim, you know, but the people that, wow, there were people that Bud Hopkins gave us the finger one time because Jim took a picture of him. That was kind of a moment in time, you know. Hey, there's that guy that I saw on that HBO show about, like, UFO abductions, and, like, he was, like, seemed really caring about people. And, oh, hey, he just gave me the finger for Jim. Well, that was reality hit, you know.
Did he take it? Did he have that? Didn't he publish the picture of Hopkins giving him the finger?
I think he took the picture and then Hopkins saw him and then gave him the finger afterwards. So I can't recall if the finger was actually photographed or it was the aftermath of the, you know, just taking the photo and then getting the finger for taking the photo. But, you know, because the same time frame, I had actually talked about Hopkins, you know, and the same, this was, of course, like my first UFO conference and so forth. And, you know, Bud Hopkins here discussing hypnotic regression, you know, a bad dream or something. It's, you know, the guy's dead now. I guess he's not going to sue me. But, you know, hey, you're not a doctor. Don't advise anybody, much less, you know, like, hey, I'm some teen guy walking around. Like, what do you think about, you know, Dr. Hopkins, you know, immediately, hey, you want some hypnosis? You know, wow, hey, that's kind of a weird offer yeah, you know, it's people that go into the field often seem to fall into one of these extremes pretty quickly, even those that start out somewhat sane or non-dogmatic.
But yeah, Jim, well, we
seem to lose that.
We can talk about that, too. Yeah, we can talk about that. That brought up, I thought of some other stuff I want to talk about later, basically about Michael Persinger, but we'll bring that up when it comes up.
Yeah, I was just watching that video of his that he, you know,
Yes, we will talk about that. Why didn't you want to continue doing Saucer Smear? We talked about a little bit this about this last week, too. You and Vince Ditchkus, I guess, were assigned to continue publishing Saucer Smear, but you decided not to. Why was that?
Chris Roth, I think, officially had at one point talked to Jim about doing it. Jim had mentioned it to me. And, you know, I without being able to realize it at the time, I realized what we both realized, I guess, later, that Jim was Saucer Smear. There was no way to, you know, the whole persona and the creation of the thing, you know, just the, he sat down at a typewriter and typed the thing, and then, like, he'd paste the photo in there, and he'd take it to a guy, and a guy would print the thing, and, you know, it was it's like remake your grandmother's cookies, you know, or something, I guess. It's just not possible, regardless of what you do, because your grandma didn't make them, you know. Similarly, I guess, in that situation. So I think Jim actually, I guess, and he appreciated that in the end, even rather than someone that would just want to try to take it and run with it as a, you know, as a mechanism of some desire of their own or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you couldn't. I mean, what are you supposed to do? Be Jim? I guess you can't. So it's, yeah. I think that was the right decision. I don't like that it's gone. But I think anything that anyone else would have done just wouldn't, people wouldn't have liked it. It just wouldn't have worked, yeah. I don't think. At least not as, not being called Saucer Smear anyway.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There's no way to continue on the name or the appearance of only indirect influence, I guess, as you know, as we'd say. But still, Jim's still with us, you know.
Yeah, well, are there any plans for a book or, like, online repository? Well, there kind of is one now that Tim, what's his name? All these Tims. The guy that owns UFO Video.
Is it Banal?
No, Tim Banal's the host of Banal of America. This is another Tim. Anyway, he owns UFOvideo.com or something like that. I haven't talked to him in a while.
Well, there was a lot of stuff that popped up, and I was really happy about that, and at first, I was going to try to coordinate in some sense or to store or to, but, you know, there were just so many. Lauren Coleman wrote a great, you know, thing on Jim, and a lot of people did. And, you know, there were so many kind of tributes that, you know, thankfully no one has to try to, you know, elicit anything from anybody. People were trying to tell their story, you know, and that was great with me, you know. That it just took on kind of its own. Nobody had to drive it, you know. It's just people telling their, you know. But it would be, you know, to either in some form, you know, some either anthology or, you know, or inspired kind of essays or whatnot. But yeah, I'm.
You are cutting out so much. I can't even understand what you're saying. So I think I'm going to do the phone thing.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's just untenable in the format that I've got it now. It's ridiculous.
Okay.
So let me give you a call here. We'll hang up off the Skype, which is dying here in the first half hour, which is ridiculous. And I will call you on the phone and mic that like I used to do.
All right, man.
All right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, can hear you fine.
Okay,
that's a little better. Well, at least this won't cut out because I'm just miking the cell phone.
Well, I don't know where I dropped out at, you know. So.
You were talking about but that Saucer Smear was basically Jim Moseley, and you couldn't really continue it in that format because it just wouldn't be the Saucer Smear everybody was used to. I had a couple questions about Jim that people don't seem to bring up, and that's where we left out. Is there any plans? For a book or anything, you said no, not really. It would be nice. What happened to Jim's files and books and everything?
I know a couple of people were sent, you know, or either recently or over the years, you know, boxes of stuff, but I'm not really sure who has most of it. I know he had Tom Benson, he had sent a lot of stuff to. I don't know, eventually. You know what? If there's any one person that has the majority of like his notes and so forth, but you know, it's I mentioned to Jim, you know, if he had anything that you know, sure, Jim set up things how he wanted to. I'm not sure if, for example, he said he had about 100 pages of notes from his original, you know, Flying Saucer tour of America back in the 50s, but you know, he just felt that there wasn't enough there to really do anything with. And shamefully, I don't know if, you know, hopefully someone salvaged the material and so forth, but couldn't really tell you to be sure.
Huh. Well, that sucks. I don't know what happened to that stuff. What happened? Did his daughter get involved with anything with his funeral or anything like that?
I don't know if you know Jim's daughter, but if you did, that probably explained things pretty quickly. But she's a young lady with issues of her own, and, you know, for example, I think she was going to mail out the last issue of Smear, and Jim had somehow prepared that before he, you know, left this plane, but I didn't really think it was going to happen, you know, and so yeah, it didn't. You know, the envelopes never got stuffed, even though the name was printed, so that's the electronic release, you know.
So it was released electronically, but his daughter was going to send it out, but she didn't. But you've got it actually on your site on mojomachine.net, right? A link for it?
Yeah. And people put up mirrors. Jim meant for it to go out, you know, so there you go. It's there. His last thoughts that he decided to put into his last issue, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah, I mean, at least the thing got out there, and it was funny. It was no different than any other issue.
Which is great, yeah, which is what I loved about it exactly. You know, it wasn't somber or, you know, anything like that. It was soft for me, just like it always was, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but I recall, I think, maybe the last interview he did where he was on, and I think I was on with you and Smiles, and he said some interesting stuff that he hadn't said, I think, before publicly.
Oh, yeah, he did, yeah.
What was it he was talking about? Was it Richard Doty, or who was he talking about that he couldn't
I
say
can't
it or something?
Oh, I don't know. I could not remember. It might have been some personal thing about Bill Moore. It was Bill Moore, I think. He was saying something about Bill Moore, and then he was saying, well, I know you're friends with him, and I shouldn't say this. And I was like, you know, Jim, nothing you say would offend me. Don't even worry about it.
Yeah, you're right. I suddenly had a flash over to Bill Cooper. I got the names transposed there. I'm like, wow, you're still hanging out with Bill Cooper, Greg. That'd be a whole different story, but...
Yeah, well, Jim can hang out with Bill Cooper now, although he's not going to, I don't think.
Wow. Jim said, here's a guy with a wooden leg that gets drunk at UFO conferences and challenges people to fight. You know, which, the wooden leg being the best part, I think. But,
yeah, well, it's not even funny without the wooden leg. Yeah, it's like that meme with the hook drunk octopus wants you to fight. It should be one with Bill Cooper with his fists up. You know, drunk ufologist wants you to fight. Yeah, wants to fight you.
He eventually picked the wrong battle, I guess, as we'd say. You know,
well, I think that's I think that's what he wanted to do. He had the police shoot. He was a suicide by cop. Yeah.
Which he had his intention of some kind of Ruby Ridge recreation or something, I guess, right?
Yeah.
I don't recall, you know, now that we mentioned, I don't know if you want to talk much about it, but Bill Cooper and what I don't even remember the story of how his book supposedly came round, Behold a Pale Horse. I just recall the era of, I think the ISS when the show UFOs Are Real Live or something was on, and, you know, around that same time frame, and the Area 51 stuff and S4 and all that, you know.
Yeah, it was like 87 or 88 through probably the end of the 90s, but it was really hopped up like in the 90 to 95 area, right when Excluded Middle started and when we first started talking.
Right. But I was thinking, you know, back to Jim, you know, he introduced me to some of the we met Wendley Strieber, you know, who, you know, of course, Jim had met numerous times, all these guys. Jim knew Bruce McAbee, and, you know, he had such a great way of kind of, you know, summarizing, who these guys were, you know, and not just their, well, I mean, as I guess he said, you know, we can say, as he said about Bruce McAbee, he's a nice guy, but he's also the most gullible man I've ever met in my life, you know. Jim had that kind of insight, you know, there's personality factors involved. Obviously, when we're talking about saucers, and it sometimes surpasses the science and the. I don't know if we can. You know, I guess we might agree on that about certain folks in the field. But.
Well, I probably do agree with you on a lot of them. I certainly agreed with Jim on just about everybody, mainly because Jim had the same. You know, he had the attitude I like, which you mentioned at the beginning. You know, you can't, you know, as soon as you express a belief in it, in anything, in the UFO field, you start to look stupid because it doesn't apply all the time. So why have a fixed opinion? So, and the fun thing was he would point out how silly people looked that had these fixed opinions and kept having to, you know, stand in the tower they built for themselves and fight off attackers. You know, with a faulty tower, to coin a phrase, and guns and crossbows and from the outside just looking silly to everybody. So that's one of the things I really admire about Jim, and that you brought up earlier. And when I first heard that he had died, I just said, you know, he was the Hunter Thompson of ufology. That's what he was to me.
My best quote to lame, you know, summary of. I guess the state of things these days would be kind of, I said this on my Twitter account, follow me at pound, you know, the Jim, if this were a comic, and it kind of is, you know, the UFO scene is kind of a comic book, that we're now leaving the golden age or the silver age or, you know, but Jim's passing.
Yeah.
Kind of marks the turning to me at least. So, you know, as Jim asked himself, you know, well, who's up there? Ready to shake it up. Not many people, apparently, is the answer, by the way. Or not well, at least, I guess, we could say.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's people trying, but I think it should. It's something that's going to come from the phenomenon itself. Or some, total iconoclast that has something that lasts for longer than a month. Some idea or something like that.
That's kind of, I guess, bridging topics why I've had more interest in some more... should we say repeatable or, you know, phenomena that can be maybe even experimentally looked at, but at the very least, you know, things that, you know, who's to say when someone's going to see a UFO? By definition, we don't, you know. But, you know, at least within in other, and, you know, I would argue related anomalous kind of fields, right? Psi or you know, poltergeist or and what 14 kind of stuff, generally speaking, you know, at least you've got something there that's sometimes repeatable, sometimes measurable, sometimes experimentally, you know, evocable or whatever you want to say.
Yeah. I said that people could call in starting about 10 minutes ago if they wanted to talk about Jim Moseley with you and I. I had one question about it was 2 weeks ago, I think, you called in and you mentioned something about Jim smoking pot. And you would think that he was a stoner, but I never knew that because he kept it very secret.
It was back, pre 9/11 days, of course, you know, it was in a suitcase right next to the aerosol can of Glade. I recall once some kids had set off a fire alarm at a conference. Well, Ridley Streamer was also, you know, I got stuck in the elevator with Ridley Streamer. Now, he jokingly said it was because of his effects on electronics. Which is a great story, but then you've got the part where you're stuck in an elevator with Ridley Streamer for 4 hours. That's not fun, you know, but anyway.
Was he?
It wasn't that long, but it did happen, yeah. We were in the elevator, and, you know, the thing just dies for no reason and reboots, and there we go again. But, you know, everybody's, oh, sorry, guys. Ha, ha, ha.
Who said that? Streamer said that?
Yeah, Ridley said that, yeah. Someone said, oh, maybe that's you, Ridley. You know, oh, geez, sorry, yeah.
Can you please start the elevator again? Thank you very much. I was at the Roswell 95, celebration, party, whatever it was, 50th anniversary. I think that was the second time I had hung out with Jim. The first time was when I did an interview with him. And the second time was at that Roswell thing. And I remember he took us... And you probably know these people. There's like a couple friends of his, like elderly couple that, like, I guess they live in an Airstream or something like that. But they had this huge ice chest. And when I came into their room, They were staying in a hotel, but when I walked into the room, they said, help yourself, and they opened the ice chest. There's a full bar in that thing. Every liquor, every mixer, everything, you know, there were olives.
Well done, wow. You have to go to prepare, I guess.
And the other thing he did was he, I took a pic, we were out waiting for a band or something to start, and there were these girls walking around with like those glow sticks and things on their heads, and they gave Jim a couple. And I've got a picture of him with a beer in his hand, standing between these two hot chicks. Like,
standing next to him, right?
So maybe that's...
Yeah, great. Jim was, you know, always the ladies' man, too, on the down low, but, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, so the other thing I had, a question I had about Jim was, he showed a certain face to, you know, me and people he didn't know so well in public and all that. Was he any different when people weren't listening? I mean, besides being a little bit more open like most people are.
Honestly, I wouldn't say that, you know, I guess to use it, that the psychology approach, you know, that his Venn diagram pretty much overlapped. You know, he was who he was. You know, it was Jim, you know, for the most part, obviously. But now, you know, he was always on. You know, that was the thing. It wasn't like he had to turn it on. He was always, you know, he was always funny. He was always hilarious. He always had these, you know, stories and all these insights, and, you know, so there wasn't, I guess, another side that I'm aware of, at least. What you saw, what you got, you know, with him, which was appreciable, you know, definitely.
Yeah. If people do want to call in to talk about Jim, it's 213-252-0998. Anything you want to say about him or... somebody says that you sound pretty crappy on whatever you're talking through my cell phone. Yeah, it doesn't sound that good. I don't know what else to do about it. I don't know how to make it more understandable than it is. I don't know if it's my cell phone or what you're talking on or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The Skype thing was working briefly, but that's...
The Skype sounded even worse.
Thing anyway.
The Skype was even worse. I mean, you would cut out like every 30 seconds.
Nobody has a hard line anymore. You know, even if you got a hard line, you don't have a hard line. You've got a white hard line. But anyway, that's a whole different thing. But yeah, you know, Jim was always and continually encouraged me to, you know, keep pursuing, you know, in whatever way, you know, anomalous stuff, I guess you'd say. And, you know, like I said, that's kind of where my interests, I don't want to say interests are aware, but, you know, with ufology just being such a, you know, dear, such a mess. You're irredeemably so, almost, you know. But, given the nature of the phenomenon, it, you know, related anomalous experiences that seem to share similar qualities that can be measured more, that might have more, you know, replicability and so forth. You know, even those that center around, well, you know, talking about Willie Streber, for example, and here's a guy who claims that he has effects on, you know, external electronics, right? You know, that's something that's not just a sighting of, you know, experience that was a one-time incident. So, you know, those kind of things. I'm reading a bit more on the, you know, the history of, you know, the whole thing from on the para, the Psy field, and Ryan and all those guys. And it's really interesting stuff, you know, a lot of which I see these really massive overlaps, you know, with a lot, you know, with some of the obvious ones with the UFO cases, especially this kind of Oz factor kind of, you know, I don't want to say trance state, but you know, altered state possibility. But I think Jenny Randles, I guess, first talked about that, right? What was the concept that maybe you can verbalize it better to me, that it was kind of an altered state of consciousness, or
Well, her thing was not, her Oz factor thing was not so much. I think it was a little both internal and external, but I think the main reason that this term was coined was to describe the strange things that happen around a anomalous experience, like of course, you know, cameras not working or engines cutting out, and then if you move more into the psychological, more like people being in some sort of altered state, having a hard time recalling what happened, sometimes not thinking about it till years later. And just the associated strangeness.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I was kind of going to get at. I'd seen this, I think, in an early paper or a book, you know, from UFO Experience or somewhere. There was a question asked. It came up again recently, and I don't know really what they meant, so I don't know what this is we're answering yes to, but people reporting that often they were thinking of something unusual or something funny, something strange happened just prior to the incident, right? You know, really kind of, like I said, the wording of the question, which I saw, it was like an academic paper, but they didn't really explain what they might have included by that. But, you know, this idea that people are thinking about something odd or unusual, and then something happens that's, you know, maybe almost preceded by some kind of synchronicity or something. But I'd like to see more data or even more narratives about that. You know, well, narratives are data, but,
yeah,
you know, just the views have been censored so much by a lot of the UFO proponents, however you want to phrase that.
Yeah, I should re-mention to people that are listening now, if they missed the beginning here, that Tim has a PhD in what type of psychology? Cognitive experimental psychology. Why did you go into that as opposed, like something academic like that, as opposed to, I don't know, a clinical practice or some other aspect of it?
I actually, you know, my initial attempt at going for my graduate career was going to be that, but, you know, I realized, you know, to some degree, I just don't want the practical aspect of it, you know. In other words, I don't want to hear other people's problems all day.
yeah.
But, you know, the ability to, you know, still kind of, I like doing the professor thing and then doing a little bit of the research thing as well, which, you know, I'm hoping to amp up more and more. You know, so that's, clinical was just, once I saw what those guys had to go through, you know, it was just, oh, geez, don't worry about that. But,
yeah.
But, you know, there are some good clinicians, I think, who are in the para and the psi field. But, that, you know, there's kind of a discussion right now, I think, I guess you say, in the psi or the anomalous field or whatever. You know, the discussion of, you know, even the use of the term parapsychology anymore is whether that's a loaded, you know, a loaded term or what. But, you know, a lot of talk about, you know, experimental approaches. But I went on my tangent there and then I forgot the original question. Sorry about that.
No, well, my question was originally why you didn't go into something like clinical psychology, which you'd answered.
I was getting at this idea of clinical parapsychology, which has been used a bit, where you know, the focus is sometimes more on the characteristics of the reporters and what kind of things they share, that which don't, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a psychological purely, you know, phenomenon, but what people are more sensitive to, you know, or more prone to have these kind of weird experiences. And I think that's an interesting way to go, you know, to at least start finding out, you know, well, who is it that's reporting this stuff first off? You know, who's saying they can do it or who's saying they've seen it or whatever, you know, and then, you know, trying to go from there.
Yeah. Well, it's... Did you meeting Jim and being exposed to all this weirdness early on, is that I would think that had an effect on what you decided to pursue as a career?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, it was, first my thought was, you know, philosophy, and then reading Jung was probably very poorly, you know, at that age, but, you know, along with John Keel and Jung's Flying Saucer, The Modern Myth, you know, right there, alongside, you know, Ballet, and unfortunately maybe guys like Bud Hopkins lending credibility to that, but you know, it was, yeah, definitely, and Jim was always encouraging about, you know, remembering that as I became, even as I guess maybe we all do, become more jaded, as, you know, you see more hoaxes or just more of life in general, but, you know, retaining that knew about UFOs, it won't be thanks to the UFO field. It'd be something that probably emerges from the phenomenon itself.
But yeah, either emerged from a phenomenon itself or a realization from some other recognized discipline of how to deal with the UFO subject, and maybe more importantly, from where you're coming from, how really all we're left with is people's impressions and their experience and the richness of that experience, and not just, you know, photos and videos and all that stuff, which are very easily fake now. So that change may come from some realization from some other field that has nothing to do with UFOs, and somebody has to make that connection. Maybe it'll be you.
No, that was only Jim's pet talk, you know, for me. Was that you could be the guy, man. You could be the guy. Yeah. Always very flattering, but, you know, the question becomes, can one, could, you know, the problem is, or, you know, as that way, I guess, would say, the problem is so multifaceted that almost like one of those classic, well, the brain that's smart enough to understand itself is too smart to be understood, or, you know, there's so many aspects to all this stuff. It's like, where do you even begin to start to try to put the pieces together? But I think some of the people in like anthropology, for example, who were just, you know, recording narratives and, you know, not doing any kind of necessarily inferences about what, you know, people really saw, quote unquote, but, you know, first, let's just get on the record. What the heck did they actually say? You know, as a scientific endeavor, at least, you know.
Yeah, but that's already kind of what's been done. You know, what did they say? What did they see? But I don't know. Tell me what you think of this. The last few shows and the last few months, anytime the topic has come up, I said, well, why don't people start asking when they're talking to UFO witnesses, how did it make you feel? And then come back a month later and say, has your life changed in any way? Did you go through a divorce? Did you go through a personality change? What did you have for lunch that day? Just totally off the wall stuff that may, you know, people are all so interested in the physicality of it.
Kind of what I was getting at with the, you know, I guess in the psi field, if you, you know, equatable to the kind of the clinical approach where, you know, what impact does this have on the person? You know, does it change, as you say, you know, do they hold new world views? Do they have a, you know, a breakdown, or do they, you know, have no impact whatsoever? Or, you know, what is the effect that it has on them? And, especially, you know, think about the contactees and the cases where people are, you know, have repeated experiences. It's especially interesting. But I think that approach has some promise, you know, to look at it as it's not just an event. It's an event that involves a person and the stimulus and the time and a place and, you know, all those factors that are obviously have to be thought about at the same time.
Right. I mean, it has to be looked at. I think it what's been missing here is having to look at it in psychological context, which would be what you're trying to do. Actually, you're more interested in parapsychology rather than the UFO angle. And you mentioned a little while ago, probably about half an hour ago while we were talking, a definite link between the kind of stuff you're interested in, the parapsychology, if I can call it that, and any other anomalies, like specifically UFOs we're talking about. What do you see, any connections between the two, you know, from your point of view, and what are they?
Yeah, I mean, just at the outset, you know, I guess my mentioning of kind of the odds factor kind of conveys to me possibly the word, I guess, trans-state is the term technically we might use, but, you know, it is someone in an altered state of consciousness during which this happened, you know, which seems to be true in a lot of cases with other phenomena, you know, and whether it be, and there might be, there's suggestion at least that there are underlying shared components, I guess you'd say. Thanks to the folks at the University of West Georgia who had us over to check out, for example, the Bill Roll archives, William Roll, who did a lot of work in the psi field and worked on a lot of poltergeist care. We actually went and looked at some of his original notes on the very famous poltergeist case he worked, and it's just great you know, that was kind of, you know, what keyed it in, that here's the thing where at least you have phenomenon that is somewhat repeatable, that's occurring, centered around something we can, a time or a place or a person that we can focus in on, so that we're not just up chasing, you know, a light and waiting for it to pop back up with no idea of what the rhyme or the reason is.
Yeah.
And this guy had drawn out, you know, here's where, you know, hour one, this object flew across the room and I was sitting there, you know, and I was like, well, okay, wow, well, I've got something, you know. But, yeah, Persinger, if you wanted to get into that, but his latest, discussion there kind of tried to tie, say, all those kind of things together, it seemed to me, as well. And I guess that's kind of the way that pendulum is swinging, generally speaking.
Well, what's funny about Persinger is a lot of people had, well, a lot of kind of believer, I guess, type people had gotten disenchanted with him, because he said that early on he had built this helmet, if people know about this, called, which they nicknamed the God Helmet, which placed magnetic fields at certain angles to the brain, and repeatable and adjustable strengths, angles, etc., and had produced religious, numinous, I don't know what you call them, experiences in people's heads.
He used the term sense presence, which I think actually goes back to William James, you know, this idea of a sense presence, that there is another intelligence around you.
And skeptics, well, at least fundamentalist skeptics, were saying, well, you know, aha, here's what's going on. It's all due to, you know, strange anomalies in magnetic fields that people go through, and that's what these things are, all of them. And then he comes out recently and says that, starts talking about how his helmet and his, you know, other aspects of his research can enhance remote viewing and precognition and things like that. And that, yeah, you know, that throws everybody, he's right back in this camp.
I just watched this earlier, and he actually made the claim we're developing a device to help, to read minds. We're building a machine. I made the statement, the claim that there is, you know, we're constructing a device that in the future you'll be able to. Okay, that's a I didn't expect to hear that from him, you know, kind of what happened over the weekend there, Michael, you know.
what did he really specifically say? They're developing a device to do what?
To allow the reading of mind or the conveyance of information from mind to mind, something along it. You know, it was basically he strapped on a God helmet on person A, strapped on a God helmet on person B, and displayed some evidence that the transmission of information between those two people and you know, what would be a usual psychic kind of experiment was enhanced by use of this God helmet or the relate whatever the new device, whatever, you know.
So he's back on the new agey people's side, and it's not because he cares about that. It's because he did some more research and said, "Oh, I think he's trying to be honest about what he's found," and it's pointing him in that direction.
I hope so. I mean, it was interesting.
Who knows what it means?
I did not see him doing that. I did not see him going that way. Let's hope it's a good thing, not a break with reality or anything like that some people have suffered in the field.
Yeah, he doesn't. He doesn't pull a Lily on us, you know.
Yeah, right. Did they actually? You know, we'll be making available a device in the near future that will allow conveyance of information from mind to mind, and goes into, you know, kind of the Rupert Sheldrake idea of the morphogenic field around the Earth and the 7 hertz being
the carrier wave?
Brains, yeah, and that's what brains, you know, kind of the Akashic record, he mentioned that, but kind of that almost, you know, that kind of idea that we're actually all fluctuating at the same hertz, and if we get exactly on the same hertz, that, you know, I can tell you what I'm thinking without telling you, okay? Well, yeah, you know what I mean, but like I said, I did not expect to hear that from him, so and he has apparently been doing a lot of research on people who kind of claim psychic abilities and, you know, certain powers and mediumship, and has found that they do have, different responses, for example, to his God helmet, and as well as different brain waves during their, whatever you want to call it, their...
trance state?
Yeah. And that some of them actually are able to tell when the thing is on and off. right, you know, whereas most people, it takes them a while to kind of tell us this, you know, what's going to happen. And well, there are some people that are that claim psi abilities that, for example, you know, just know immediately, okay, well, yeah, I can feel it, you know, or you know, so on. So he's done a lot more in the para kind of arena than I guess most people have, or at least has been, you know, kind of shown publicly on you know, Discovery Channel and all those places where you see him at. You know.
Yeah, it seems like when there's not to change the subject too much, but when you see something like this on a Discovery Channel or a History Channel or whatever the hell, it's one of two things. It's either it's, you know, a complete believer or a total crap, and there's no real in between. There's no excluded middle about this where they say, well, let's look at the. There was a show for a while, I think, called ESP Proof or Parapsycho, whatever it was, but it was just they would take a case and then they would decide whether there was enough evidence for it or not. And sometimes there was
a fiction thing that was only called Fact or Fiction, which I saw that was
maybe it was, yeah. That somebody listening probably knows, probably most of the people listening probably know, but they don't, it's stuff like this that we're talking about, like Persinger's thing. I don't know if they could reduce that down to a show. It'd be quite a talent to do it. And I think just the fact of exposing hundreds of thousands or millions of people to this information would help move it along, rather than trying to have people make up their mind one way or the other and, you know, and move along. It'd be nice to have people actually thinking about it in a non-dogmatic way. But it's tough. Non-dogmatic television is tough television, you know, to sell.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the term, you know, jumps into my mind is ambiguity tolerance, you know. And
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Got this thought out there that if you are unable to tolerate ambiguity, you're more likely to see, you know, signals and noise and flying saucers or, you know, whatever else they like to tag on there as you know, being the same. But, you know, people just can't tolerate. It's easier to know, oh, that's what that is, than to go, okay, I don't know what that is. I'm still going to lead my life, and, you know, without having to try to, you know, put a classification on it or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I think this is what we started talking about when we first met. Well, I don't know if we've ever met, but had first started communicating with each other. It was like if you put something in a category, you've already made a decision about it at some level. Like when somebody says, well, what are UFOs? And then immediately, what does everybody think of? Aliens from other planets. There's no real, it's aliens from planets or it isn't. Bigfoot exists as a physical thing or he doesn't. ESP exists as something that is completely, you know, reliable or it doesn't. And none of that is applicable. If you look at any of these things for more than, you know, a little while with an open mind, you realize that none of that's, there's no either or. On any of these things.
Definitely you know, to use a pun almost, a challenge to science. I mean, this is, you know, these are, you know, weird events that sometimes, you know, I guess that's what they share in common almost, you know, weird events. And this was something that came up on the discussion group. You know, I think I put the question out there actually was that this should cryptozoology fall under this, you know, kind of umbrella of era psychology or anomalistic, or is cryptozoology, you know, a biological study, or you know, where there's cases where obviously it's, you know, somewhere in the middle, you know.
Yeah.
So even defining what we're talking about, you know, at the outset is tough from a scientific point of view, you know.
Well, my answer would be both, but what came up on the discussion?
Pretty much that. I mean, you do have some cases and some instances and some people who are focused more on biologically undiscovered or biological, you know, entities that are undiscovered creatures that are, you know, flesh and blood. And then you have, you know, cases that are apparent when, like, we're talking over at West Georgia is one of the grad students there said, you know, entity cases, you know, what we call them. You know, exactly that. You know, we don't know what
cases?
Entity cases.
Oh, entity. Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, a hairy dwarf, is that a biological, I mean, you know, these South American cases that Jim used to, you know, he always loved the South American cases because they were so strange, you know, hairy dwarfs chasing guys around and stuff. And like, is that a cryptozoological problem? Do you call a Lauren Coleman for that? Or do you, I mean, who do you call for a hairy dwarf?
Yeah, and I don't remember any hairy dwarves being around anywhere, really, in any numbers, besides South America in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, yeah, which is an interesting, you know, does that mean it's almost a more pure measure because they had less of a cultural, or is it just a different cultural bias, or you know, it kind of starts to get at those questions, I think, but, you know, answering them, of course, is like a lot tougher, but...
Yeah. Well, it's. I think if the questions were expanded to include quote unquote stupid questions or impossible ones considered in a serious way, that might work.
What were you thinking about at the time? And then to find out that 50% of people say, you know, something unusual, like the fact that I had a dream about something that happened, and then bang, a saucer shows up, or whatever it is, you know, whatever this unusual,
yeah,
you know, thinking is, you know, who knows what. You know, what's going on, that all the information we can use, we can have would be useful.
Well, let's go back to something that might not be quite as useful, but interesting psychologically. You mentioned living next to Ed Walters and the coverage that got from the news, and specifically Bruce Maccabee. And what do you think was going on? Because I noticed on your site, on mojomachine.net, there was a fairly long, at least for that site, discussion about what was going on in Gulf Breeze and what might have been there, and the suggestion that it was made up based on an old drawing of you, of what people thought they had seen with UFOs, like from the 50s or 60s.
Oh, man, that's something that actually back in the day, I kind of addressed in a more thorough manner, but, you know, the short of it, I think, is whether or not Ed Walters saw that image or that picture, which was, I guess, an artist's representation of various saucer reporting, you know, cases that were reported, and,
yeah,
you know, what was it, from the 70s or something, whether he flipped through a book and saw that or not, there's something wrong there. It looks about exactly like his, you know. And the fact that, regardless of whether or not, you know, that's the origin of his his design, I still think they were his design, you know. He had the other, you know, part of the case, which was totally different, this weird red light, which was, you know, seemingly related, at least, you know, on the surface level, because it was in the air, and, you know, people didn't know what it was, but yeah, you know, it was something I saw years ago, just flipping through an old, you know, saucer book. Here's a collection of saucers that have been seen, you know, as represented by an artist.
I've seen that.
It does look a lot like, you know, I mean, down to the portholes and where they're at, you know.
And the fin coming off the back.
The fin, I couldn't tell if that was fin or an attempt to draw, like, motion. That was one thing that could be, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
To me, but it was, you know, it looked very, very similar. Regardless, the photos looked very, very hokey, you know.
Yeah, well, the skeptic would say... Well, this fundamentalist would say, well, he took that drawing and he made models of it. And then the believer UFO person would say, well, that just means he saw the same kind of UFO that the person saw in 1950, whatever. So, you know, what are you left with? There are a lot of questions around what he was doing. But the thing is, on top of that, you also had a link to a description of what was going on at the military bases around Gulf Breeze at the time, and how they were testing things like UAVs.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the places that they did some of the drone, you know, a lot of the drone stuff, and they've got psychological operations, you know, stationed there. One of the special operation wings or whatever has the PSYOPs division there, and, you know, if you're in a town almost, it's maybe, you know, 50 miles away, but if you're a PSYOP guy, and you're luckily placed with, you know, these fake UFO photos on television, and everybody in town believes it, and you don't do something with it, you know, you're not doing your job, you know. So that was always my kind of, at least on some level, my suspicion that it was kind of put on by someone who had the ability and the desire to see how people would react, you know.
Yeah. What do you make of Bruce Maccabee saying that it was absolutely real and that people should take it seriously?
I guess I can fall back to Jim on that. Bruce Maccabee's a nice guy, but he's also the most gullible man I've ever met. you know, he did a photo analysis, spectrum analysis of the, I know he endorsed not only the original Ed Walters UFO big photos, but the red light thing that, you know, was basically a burning kind of, it was a flare tied to a parachute or something, is what it looked like to me.
Yeah.
That could be the sophisticated spectrum analysis showing that, well, the constituents show that it's slightly not a railroad flare. Okay, but it's still a big ball of flaming something, which is like actually dripping stuff, you know, like when you light plastic on fire, the cars drip off, you know.
Yeah.
And not what the guy had in the picture, you know, this is something else, you know, and it's, you know, so they would have, they're, you know, they're on video, and they're, well, you know, I saw them, you know, they, you know, they were, sometimes they'd blink on one, two, three, four, and, you know, kind of in a sequence, but so it didn't seem accidental, you know, let's put it that way.
Yeah, there was a lot of weird shit flying around Gulf Breeze at the time that Walters is doing this, and it sounds, it almost sounds to me like kind of a Kirtland Air Force Base thing where, like, yeah, there probably were some real unidentifieds, whatever those are,
yeah,
flying around at the time, but there was also a lot of military stuff going on at the same time. So I think that
confusion helps them.
Yeah, yeah, I think they're fine with that. They're fine with that because it keeps serious people away.
Yeah, which I think was actually in the last, was it the Rupel to the Condon report or whatever, it was kind of the last official word on what to do about the saucer problem, was basically to, you know, to investigate in ways that it can be exploited by ridiculing witnesses and like possibly using it as confusion tactics and things like that. Of course, that's been well kind of discussed by guys like Valet, but you know, I think it really is. There are some cases where it's really probably the answer, you know, which, I don't know, I think with Gulf Breeze, there's too much there of, you know, there's too much something happening there that that would be my, if I had to pick one and guess, but do you want to go with, you know?
That would be what?
If I had to pick a solution that was, what happened there with Gulf Breeze, it would be something along those lines, you know, Ed Walters faked some photos and someone, you know, over at the PSYOPs, at the base of the PSYOPs unit said, hey, why don't we go float some mysterious red lights over there and see what people do.
Yeah.
And of course, they ended up, you know.
But those aren't the only things that were seen. All kinds of strange things were seen, not just Ed Walters thing, not just that light. All kinds of stuff, which is why I was saying I don't know if there was some legitimate, quote-unquote, unidentifieds flying around there at the time. There could have been, for all we know.
Yeah, and it even, I guess, kind of brings up that question, which some people don't want to address, of, well, could you have a charged atmosphere, quote-unquote, I mean, whatever that means. Can you set up a scenario in which people are looking for, and not just in a classic psychological, you know,
yeah,
way,
yeah.
I mean this, but if people are looking and then they're seeing, you know, the flying disc emerges from the description of non-disc shaped objects by Kenneth Arnold, and the same thing to me, at least, or similar to it.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. That's that idea, I believe, was the first time I read about it was in Mothman Prophecy. And some of Keel's writings where he said, look, everybody sees all this weird stuff, but, and some of it might be fake and whatever, but so many people are looking and so many people are expecting something at a certain time. They seem to, things seem to, they create it, like it feeds itself. Whatever's yeah. going on there feeds itself and creates a sort of its own flap just by the energy of people looking for it and being excited by it, and whether the you know whether everything everybody sees is truly anomalous, it seems to increase that, and there might be some reciprocating, and I really agree with it, there might be some reciprocal thing going on there between the witnesses and whatever the thing is, hooking into those old ideas of, you know, if you have to invite the devil, and if you do, he'll come, but he has to be invited, you know.
Right, and I think to some degree this came out the other day with Dave Metcalf and I were discussing in the sci field, like with the spoon vending parties.
Yeah.
You know, I know plenty of times I've seen the Randy's explanation of how you diddle the spoon and the spoon bends, you know, whatever, with the heat from your food. But I also know that, like, the guy that invented the laser, Russell Targ, like, watched the spoon bend in front of him, you know, and seen deep. And it seems to happen when more people are involved, more people are excited, more people are, you know, is it Is it something that is, you know, induced by more people being into it? You know, however you want to phrase that, right?
Yeah, the more people that are, that quote-unquote believe that the thing is going to happen, the easier it is for it to happen. Now, of course, you know, I know skeptical people that say, well, that just means that they're more susceptible and more believable. It's like, but, you know, what about, specifically, I think I got in an argument with this guy over Uri Geller. He's, why would you even listen to that charlatan? And I said,
well,
because
he lied, but he also has, like,
he had apparent... something apparent that wasn't explainable by current science that was verified over and over in lab experiments. And sometimes it wasn't.
Yeah,
and sometimes it was.
On YouTube, he was over at SRI. I mean, I've got a pretty good, you know, if he's at SRI, he's fooling them, you know. If he's fooling, you know, these guys, he'd probably get over on me. You know, I can't, you know, he did also cheat, you know, which is, I guess, part of the problem, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I brought up one thing to my friend here. I said, look, one of the experiments was they sealed nitinol, which is that thing that's made out of nickel and, what is it, lead? Something like that. Anyway, I can't remember what the alloy is. But the property of it is that it can't be bent unless you heat it. If you heat it to, like, you know, 200 or 300 degrees centigrade, you can bend it. And then you take the heat away and the bend stays there. But if you don't heat it, it just pops back to the shape it was in. They took wires of this stuff and put them in, sealed them in glass tubes, gave them to Geller and said, you know, do what you can with them. And he bent them, and they gave the glass, sealed glass tubes back, and then they went and looked at it, and they took the wires out, and the wire was, the bend in the wire was consistent of having been heated to a point that where it could have been bent. And they watched him while he did this. I mean, he didn't like take a torch to it or anything. So how do you explain that? And, you know, the explanation was, well, then the scientists must have been in on it with him, which I don't buy. I don't buy in every case.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, there are some times when I just got to go with the fact that, you know, who was Ballet or Russell Targ or whoever is sitting there is, okay, they're all in on this. The guy that had been the laser just decided to lie for Uri Geller. I mean, it's too much at some point to believe that the guys that are smarter than me just sat there and got fooled over and over again by someone, you know, like we're talking about.
Yeah.
Of course, the fact that, and I don't know, I guess maybe the fact that it's not always replicable or repeatable, you know, maybe that's why he also had, just like any other magician, tricks up his sleeve when, you know, he did get caught, you know, busted faking some stuff, but some stuff he apparently did, and there's no explanation for it.
Yeah, it's a baby with the bathwater thing, you know? It's like, well,
yeah.
It really shows people's bias, too. I mean, if you really think the guy's a charlatan, he's like, look, he fooled people once. He should be, you know, he could fool anybody anytime. And that's true. But, you know, every time in labs of settings, under controlled conditions, always... I don't think so. I mean, if even one or two of these things shows that something was going on, then something's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's
point, right.
Right. I don't, how much further I can take it, except that. And it's not one of those things. It's not a believe or disbelieve thing. It's just kind of like, well, I'm prepared to accept whatever's going on at face value until I find out that there was, you know, something, some trickery going on.
Yeah, it's amazing how many people just, like, seem to lack this genuine, just kind of curiosity without having a dog in the fight, so to speak. You know,
yeah.
I'm not going to feel, other than hopefully not having wasted my time, you know, I'm not going to feel elated or let down or, you know, point proven or, you know, bam in your face or whatever, no matter what comes, you know, it's just, but it's exciting to see the possibility of, you know, what we don't know yet, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're getting little teases, I think, of what can be done and what can be used and how to fine-tune some. You know, I think that's what Persinger's doing. I think that's what you're doing. I think that's what Dean Radin's doing. They're trying to tease these things out in ways that can be used scientifically, repeatedly, in a repeatable way.
Yeah, I'm still kind of in shock over the... I'm awaiting my future helmet or whatever it was the person announced that we're building a machine that will. That's a bold claim. You know, I wouldn't be prepared to make any point in my lifetime. they'll be delivering a machine in the near future that'll allow ESP repeatedly. You know, at your whim. Okay. Really? Wow.
Well, I hope so. I doubt it, but I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Exactly. That's pretty much been my feeling about everything in the UFO field and the paraphilia. I doubt it, but I hope so. That'd be cool.
We're talking to Tim Brigham, who has a doctorate in psychology, so it's not like I'm talking to somebody who's just a fan or something. And you was it you that told me that your school is getting one of these to do research?
It was actually West Georgia when we were visiting. They had gotten in I think there's a version of the helmet that he makes somehow commercially available, or you know. They had gotten in one over at West Georgia where we were visiting. They were still in the process of just getting the thing, you know, hooked up and running. But really cool to know there's a God helmet somewhere in Georgia, at least, you know. So I'm sure there's definitely the possibility for some interesting research there, you know.
Are you going to be involved in that, or are you going to insinuate yourself into it, I hope?
I'm going to try. You know, I had years ago at the master's level, I actually proposed some stuff using kind of replicating or testing some of Persinger's ideas. And you know, now that there's actually, you know, some version of this thing around, it'd be nice to see if, you know, things like, and I think this is an idea that's kind of already out there in the quote, clinical parapsychology field, you know, are say mediums, do they have a more sensitive, are they more sensitive to the thing than just your standard, your control, let's say.
Yeah.
I think some of that's being done, and some of the answers seem to be, somewhat, it seems so, from what I've seen. It's all still stuff that needs replication and so forth, but definitely looks interesting, to put it that way.
Okay, so if you had full access to this God helmet that Persinger sent out in your lab, what experiments would you do with it?
Well, I'm really interested in the idea of the trans state, the odd factor, whatever you want to call it, and if that is something that let's take, for example, the glossolalia, speaking in tongues.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that requires almost, I think, a trans state to evoke the experience, or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
Is that, or would those people be more susceptible, have a different experience? The idea that they're kind of self-inducing the same kind of thing was, I think, what Persinger had kind of hinted at, right? That they're doing something that the helmet does for other people, you know, that they're doing naturally. So,
oh, I see, yeah.
So putting it on people like them, or people who report, UFO sightings, or being men in black, or psi abilities, stuff like that. What would be the effects that it would have on them?
Right.
In a multitude of ways, just broadly, generally speaking.
Well, how about I'm trying to think up an experiment myself. Oh, there's something that. Not really related to the helmet, but I was wondering if anybody could ever do, which was to take see how these things are affected or affect somebody that is, and I don't know about the ethics of this, but somebody who is basically kind of a mental patient, somebody that has extremely strange activity in their brain. And how is that affected by the helmet, or how do they affect the local environment? So as vis-a-vis Whitley Strieber turning off the elevator, supposedly, or even something like the who's that physicist that used to walk into a lab and stuff would start breaking?
Oh God, yeah, I know.
It wasn't Max Planck, or I can't remember who it was.
It's an interesting issue, and that's kind of I think the clinical, if you want to use that term, angle comes in to see. Well, what kind of people and some of the correlates on it, at least what they term positive schizotypy and things like that, measures of certain, and they're not really disorders, they're more of just kind of personality traits, right? People who are more open to new ideas, but yet more, so there are certain people, obviously, who, I guess, even self-induce these kind of things, and I think maybe that's, you know, then bring in the whole, the other angle of the stimulus and the natural setting of, you know, what, even the plasma balls or geomagnetic fields, and you got 1,000 variables already, you know.
Right.
Starting to try to pin it down, and I think one of the things that really kind of messed up the UFO field was hypnosis. You know, I think that and reliance on, you know, video and photos, and instead of, you know, I understand the temptation, but really just going back to what people are reporting, you know, seems to be the way to approach it, as opposed to trying to stand and find a mold from a saucer. You know, that's been kind of proven by time here to be silly, I think. Although Stan Freeman would probably still argue against that somehow, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the nuts and bolts people are still around, and there's a case to be made for nuts and bolts. There's a case to be made from aliens from other planets, and there's a case to be made from all other angles, but none of them have been proven yet, at least past the point where it's just somebody's belief, at least as far as I can tell.
And even questions like, well, what does the belief of the researcher seem to have in terms of effect on the findings of scientific studies? That was something that I was just taking a look at that was suggested be addressed, and what was to some degree studied. You know, the believers in psi find positive psi results, you know, and there's some data there. I'm not sure really which way it seems to go, but you know, that's a great question. You know, because maybe it's I hate to bust out a, you know, the almost tired now cliche quantum thing, but the observer separating the observer and the observed being, you know, almost impossible.
Yeah. Well, I think that's might be some of the basis of my pounding on the idea that we are far more involved in anomalous experience than we think. We just think we're being exposed to something and reacting. I think it's we're being exposed to something, and then there's an interaction, and that interaction is what we remember. We don't remember what the thing is. We have no way of knowing that, because we have no way, we have no drawer to put it in, box to put it in. So we make one.
Yeah, and then there's also the further question of, well, how much of it is the phenomenon itself that changes, and how much of it is it our interpretation of what it is that changes?
Yeah, there's a question.
Which, again, maybe is inseparable. I don't know.
Well, I think at this point it is inseparable, but the thing is that I think a lot of people looking at the problem and any anomalous information, be it from the parapsychology standpoint or the cryptozoological or UFO, any of those, they don't include themselves in the equation, or the witness in the equation.
Yeah, it's you know, the whole Betty and Barney Hill thing with it. I don't know if you remember that discussion earlier, but someone was bringing up, you know, in these kind of cases, sometimes is what's the primary goal? Should it be to gather evidence, or should it be to try to help these people who are sometimes really traumatized by whatever the hell it was that happened? And I think it should always be primarily to try to help the person, secondarily to just kind of like in the Hill case, where, you know, I think, well, maybe one of us was talking about the fact that, you know, the psychiatrist never really said he didn't really believe that what they said happened literally happened. He, you know, he said he didn't know what happened.
Benjamin Simon was a psychologist. A name I actually remembered. Go ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, hey, I'll give him credit for that. That was a heck of a thing to, you know, to put your patients first and, you know, not fly out and say, hey, I've got the first people that are on, you know, on board a saucer. And, you know, well, here was a guy that did have ambiguity tolerance, as we say. And, you know, it's an interesting case. And I'm always kind of bugged also by how people who wanted to sell that as a nuts and bolts kind of case, and, you know, always said the Hills were a typical couple in 1961.
No, they weren't.
Well, they weren't. Barney was a white man, and she was a white woman. In 1961, that was 4 years after, you know, at least in the South, the guy had been lynched and castrated, you know. Just, you know, publicly, you know, and without, you know, I mean, this was still not, this was, you know, and Barney had these, you know, knew this and had these issues about, you know, even in the book, he mentioned fear of being, you know, like, was someone going to assault them? Was someone not going to serve them? Was he going to be thrown out of a place during the, you know, their vacation? And, you know, so Barney was full aware. And, you know, it's, I think everybody else do, you know, it's, there is that component to it. You know, I'll leave it at that for now, but it makes you speculate on what they may have repressed that, that actually happened. You know, I guess suggest something without, you know, saying I really believe that, but I, not his original report or his original regression, you know, Barney's, was of seeing what a red-haired Irishman with a swastika on his arm.
What? Who? What? Who saw that?
No, you don't remember? That was what Barney saw through the binoculars when he first looked at the thing. You don't remember that?
I don't remember that. I remember saying they said they looked like Nazis.
He held the binoculars up. He saw, it's a red-headed man. He's Irish. I know Irish guys don't like black people. You see, these are like transcripts of and they start screaming, like, I've never heard anybody scream, by the way. He's making something up. You know, it's not just like he's just making something up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's scared to death. He's like, he's wearing a swastika. Like, okay. And we're just going to not bring that part up again? You know, that's kind of significant. You know, if something traumatic happened with repressed or whatever, you know, I guess I don't think we'll ever really know, you know, obviously. But it troubled Barney and Betty for, years before they even went to, you know, it was, 5 years before, you know, the book and then the... It was 2 years before they even went to the psychiatrist, I think it was. So, you know, something very, very troubling happened. You know, putting it in the perspective of the time frame and the fears that, you know, that Barney had reasonably, probably, you know.
Yeah.
Once one wonders what might have actually gone down, you know.
Yeah, it's people really don't think about that. I mean, I remember very early on in UFO Mystic, I wrote something about the idea that... I can't remember his name. Yeah, I can remember Benjamin Simon, but this other guy. The idea about the the Outer Limits episode with the alien on it that looked like the one that Barney described actually being broadcast literally, I think, like a couple weeks before or a couple weeks after they had their experience, and how that might have affected it.
And
the first thing everybody said was, why do you think that that's what happened? I said, I don't think that's what happened. I think it might have affected it.
Right.
Whatever happened, that was may have been an important contributing factor to what they thought they recalled.
Yeah. It's once again, you know. Well, so did they or didn't they get abducted by aliens, Greg? Which is it? You know, I mean.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know, and I almost don't care.
Right. Yeah.
What I care about is their experience and. And stuff you bring up, like the Irish guy with the Nazi, I don't remember hearing that. And in the book,
I
guess.
It's in the Interactive Journey. Yeah, it's like, you know, initially when he holds the binoculars up and I'm going to get my gun, you know, he reports seeing a guy with red hair, mentions he's Irish, and that I think it's something like, you know, Irish guys don't like black clothes. And he's also got, you know, he's wearing a swastika. And then, you know, then there's the big-eyed creature behind them that, you know, yeah, you know, so yeah, it's in there, you know, just as well as he remembers seeing the rest of the incident, he remembers that. So
yeah, what the hell is that doing in there? That's one of those things that, and you know, to your credit, bringing that up, that most people it's not brought up anywhere. I'm sorry, I didn't remember that. I didn't know that when I wrote that piece. I mean, it's like, you know, what the hell is that doing in there, and how does that enter?
Yeah.
I don't know
if it's a racial sensitivity attempt or if it's really what I hope it's not in, and that's making this look less weird than it really is, because, you know, then you can sell it as what you want to sell it as, but, you know, the high strangeness, you know, not just, how else can you say it, you know, high strangeness.
I know that's what it is. I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty certain that anybody that was interested in the UFO angle would actively throw that out. They would just say, that's just an anomalous thing that's, you know, it's just based on his, fears.
Yeah,
that was just based on his fears, and it was brought up by the fact that aliens were about to grab them, and it just brought that fear up. Really?
Yeah, which is kind of, reminds me of what Woodley Streamer, said, I don't know if it was recently, I read recently that, although he thinks he was part of an MK-Ultra-related program to cause dissociative multiple personalities and based on extreme trauma and so forth, and the alien recollections could be argued to just be a fantasy to protect himself, but he goes with the other explanation that the trauma caused the aliens to come find him, and when I say aliens, I mean it, you know, in the actual sense of something alien, I, you know,
does,
right?
Yeah.
Occam's razor wouldn't really, I don't know, see how that jives, but, you know, Whitley's had his experiences, and he claims that they're as real as, you know, as when you talk on the phone, you know, so
yeah.
Who am I to say they're not, you know?
I don't know if they are or not. I think a lot of it's confabulated, but that confabulation doesn't mean made up out of thin air to me.
Right.
Not in his case. And, you know, I don't know if all that stuff happened to him. But I don't know how much of it that he consciously added in there.
I don't know if he knows.
Yeah, I know. I would tend to think that he consciously added a bit of it, but most of it isn't. Most of it is him trying to make sense of something very strange. And also, no matter what people think, and people are going to say, you know, you're such a dupe, but trying to be honest about it, I think. He thinks he's trying to be honest about it. I don't know what the experiences were or what happened to him. I've had lunch with him or dinner with him one time, and I didn't get to talk to him very much. But I would at some point really like to get into depth with him about, and I don't think he'd be offended if you or I said something like that.
Yeah, I don't think so. I know since he's taken over for Art Bell, though, or he's kind of, you know, more immersed, I guess, in the field or the general public, and he's kind of got his own.
Well, he has had his own show for a while, the Dreamland show, I think.
Dreamland, okay.
I think that's what it's called. Okay, it's called something else. I am so not into the nitty gritty of the subject right now. I can't even remember what the name of the damn show was. But yeah, he has a weekly show on. I don't think he fills in for Coast to Coast anymore.
He's got his own. Yeah, the Dreamland thing must be separate. Yeah, but yeah, I know someone had written something on some of the messaging boards, and you probably saw that thing. I think Jim mentioned it actually in the last meter, the one before that. You know, the thing about Screamer and the kind of, I didn't call it a kind of a psychoanalysis of him.
I don't remember seeing it. I'd probably
see if I can find the reference. It was basically, you know, he tried to ask Whitley some questions, and Whitley kind of, well, you know, I just huffed and puffed and, you know, kind of gave half an answer. And then, you know, but I'll send it to you. It's in how Whitley's story kind of changed a little bit over time. And he didn't, you know, really, I really can't summarize it, but I'll try to find a link for you. But
yeah, well, there was a researcher, Aofis Kefos or something like that, a British guy, I believe, that wrote a very detailed psychological kind of exposition of Streber and what may have happened to him a few years ago. He was on a few shows, I think, for a while. I wanted to talk to him, but it was... and then, of course, there's that report on Communion, which was commissioned by Streber, which has a really, you know, has some good insight into what may have been going on as well.
What did you say, commissioned by Whitley?
Yeah, Report on Communion was actually commissioned. Streber hired Ed Conroy to write that book.
Oh, okay, Report on Communion, yeah, I recall that one. Ed Conroy kind of, I guess, he got paid for the job that he was paid to do, but he really didn't seem to have, I never heard much else from him, you know, about Whitley or anything else, honestly.
No, I hadn't either, but I, you know, apart from the fact that people say, well, Streber paid for that, it didn't paint him in a, you know, negative light. It actually made the story a little bit stranger in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what Streber wanted. I don't know. But, I mean, the book was fascinating on its own, whether it was done with his, well, obviously it was done with his permission. But, you know, in seeing where some of this stuff might have come from and what the background was of it and other stuff that happened to him and what his family life was like and all this other stuff.
Interesting, you know, report on Communion, report on Whitley Streber, you know, but yeah, you know, he's kind of, I don't know, embodies almost the kind of person that would seemingly have these experiences. I almost want to say, you know, this kind of does, maybe, you know, doesn't know what himself to make of it, and,
yeah,
which is, hey, great, fine, and great that you admit that and can accept that too, you know.
Yeah, I don't think he has. I think he has an artist mind, not a skeptic's mind, and you know, you have to accept it for that. Otherwise, you're just saying, like, what do you believe that for? Why are you discussing this? Like, no. he's looking at it from a different point of view than most people. And if that means it's not scientific, then it's not. But not all of human experience is science.
Yeah, and I mean, ideally, however, science can look at individuals' experiences, you know, which is the other side of the coin, which people sometimes, scientists, I think, either choose to or just forget, you know. It, you know, there are things, you know, case studies aren't just foolishness of, you know, it's, you know, there are ways to not lose the story of what happened to the person, yet still gather the data for, you know, the other purpose of trying to figure out what the heck is going on here, you know.
Yeah.
Here, meeting in general on this planet or whatever the heck we're doing, you know.
You're an assistant professor. Do you have students?
I don't have any graduate students, you mean, or what?
Well, any students. Like people would normally think of it, sitting in a classroom getting assignments from you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do they know That's about fine. Your interests, all this stuff we've been talking about?
I bring it up to a slight degree, but not, how do you say, I don't know, I guess I'm half in the closet. I don't know, you know what I mean? I'll bring it up, but, you know, very few of them are aware or alerted to my appearance on Radio Mysterio, so let's put it that way. You know, it's actually a couple of them stumbled on my tweet feed the other day, and I was like, oh, now I got it. You know, so, it's an issue, you know, realistically, if there's people who take that plunge, you know.
Yeah.
It's a risky, you know, thing for, if you want to make sure that you keep a job, you know, you make sure you, hey, which understandably sometimes, I mean, look at, you know, people like, well, we got to go so far with David Jacobs, you know, hey.
Yeah.
Even at, you know, huge universities that are respected, and then, hey, doesn't help that the guy's, he's into UFOs and he's also a lunatic. Okay, let, you know, or whatever you, his proclivities may be, let's say, but.
Yeah, well, Raiden was, like, gently sort of pushed out of UNLV because he seemed, at least that's what he says. He just said they didn't want, you know, this ESP guy teaching at their school, or at least it made them uneasy. And since he didn't have tenure, he got kind of...
he got the kind of, I guess, the...
Gently suggesting...
Have an office space for you, though, or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah. So do
you... Hey, he's a historian hypnotizing people and then working in his own kinky, you know, figure that he's in the place, you gotta do something about that, you know.
They're yeah.
Not write letters if you're teaching their kids or not a regression that might be, keeping it clean and simple, you know, so far it's
Well, I mean, it's not like you're writing books saying aliens are coming to, you know, invade the planet or taking people's DNA or raping women or anything like that. So, you know.
Which is an interesting, you know, wild as Freud, you know, just surface level Freudian kind of stuff, you know, and then also to find out that, you know, David Jacobs has these weird, you know, angles of sexual anger fetishes that somehow come into play almost in some of these, you know. Okay, that worked, you know. Thanks, buddy. Did us all a favor, I guess, there. How else do you need? But, yeah, I haven't kept up, by the way, on that whole Emma Woods thing. I don't know if that's...
I haven't either. I mean, I didn't keep up when it was happening, and it turned into sort of a minor thing because Nick and I were both on Tim Banal's show, and he asked about that, and we said we both didn't know much about it, nor did we care.
Yeah, I didn't really care about him before. I only care to the degree now that it's another embarrassment for, you know, the thing that was once called ufology or whatever you want to say.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, like, you know, a normal discipline, people, the discipline can afford to have wackos once in a while. But
yeah, exactly, right.
UFO study cannot afford to have any wackos, and that seems to be it. That's all it attracts.
Like, you know, the few that have some kind of academic standing or, you know. And,
yeah. That's all it attracts. So when people start talking about the respectability or how it has to be changed, and I'm thinking that it's impossible. There's no way that UFO study is going to be respectable ever. And when it is respectable, it won't be called UFO study. It won't be called ufology. It'll be called something else.
Yeah, bingo. I think that's kind of the same thing that other anomaly-related fields are going through. The parapsychological field is kind of like, we parapsychology word anymore. That kind of implies stuff. People kind of think, you know, crazy stuff. And, you know, that maybe a change of wording. You know, the George Carlin used to talk about the impact that just using words had.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time for a change of the words again, you know.
Have you heard any words that people might be using for cryptozoology, or ufology, or more specific to you, parapsychology?
I kind of like the anomalistic psychology, because that kind of just inclusively, without really stating what exactly an origin is. But then again, there's, you know, the argument that well, anomaly could be, but, you know, then people have, you know, used the term clinical parapsychology or anomaly, exception. Yeah, another good one that I have heard, the psychology of exceptional experiences.
Yeah.
It's a bit longer, but, you know, it does kind of capture it without putting it in a negative light. So.
Right.
But, you know, personally, I like the anomalistic psychology.
I do, too, because that exceptional word has been misused, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because people think of exceptional, it usually has a dictionary definition is a positive one. Like, this is way above and beyond, and this is a shining light. And when you use it for people that are, like, disabled or whatever, it's like, they're, that's not exceptional. It means that it's like George Carlin said, again, it's covering up a problem.
Yeah, right.
The people need attention, and, yeah. It's the people don't need attention. The people don't need to be put on a pedestal. They need attention and help. You know, so.
Yeah, and that seems to be... to make sure that the story came out the way it needed to support whatever their personal viewpoint of the, which, you know, to me was very scary. You know, I think someone, it was Mark Pilkington or one of those guys, John Rimmer, you know, one of the Magellan guys, it was Mark Topmeyer. I wrote an article that I think I had suggested something to him, you know, and maybe in regards to his origin about, you know, you got to be careful of which guy you go to if you want to get hypnotic regression, because you could either end up with love and light or, you know, anal probes and aliens from their reticuli, you know, raping you. I mean, this is a, you know, and you know, and apparently it's going to happen again and again and again. So there's a cause for concern when, you know, depending which guy you go to, you have a completely different recall of what happened.
Yeah. Very early on, when I interviewed that guy, Mario Pozzaglini, he said that the one quote I remember from him in that regard to that was, these people have little knowledge or respect for the subconscious.
Yeah, well, or even some of them, the conscious mind, you know, I mean, just some of the knowledge about the nature of what hypnosis does to memory is makes it not usable in court testimony. You know, it's in some form of it is basically guided relaxation and guided imagery, imagination. What are you guys doing? And you're not even clinicians, much less psychologists, you know, but Hopkins is an artist, you know.
So what
people accidentally refer to him as Dr. Hopkins because they assume, because of the fact that he's treating people as if he's treating them like patients, you know.
Yeah, they used to refer to George Adamski as Dr. Adamski, so.
well, at least with him, I'd enjoy that more. That'd be more fun than that.
Well, being trained in psychology, what do you, and I think I've heard a little bit of it, and I think I know where you'd go with it, but if somebody was a psychologist and they were going to work with somebody that was having exceptional or anomalous experiences, what do you think the approach should be from now on? Because we know what the mistakes were in the past. We've been talking about them. But what do you think would improve that?
Man, it's a tough one because it's almost like go to somebody who doesn't have an opinion or an extra guy. Well, how do you find a guy? You know, and someone actually on Facebook, you know, I think, posed that question the other day. Can you recommend anybody for hypnotherapy or, you know, professionally? No. No. You know, like, that wouldn't, you know, if the thing is really to find out truthfully what happened during some, you know, repressed incident, I wouldn't go to anybody for hypnotherapy, and I certainly wouldn't go to anybody who specializes in it, in about the people and then making sure that they're okay, not just about the pushing of an agenda or even, you know, the valid gathering of knowledge for science. You know, it's first about people that have to live with the crap, you know?
Yeah. I think this came up on the show, too, and I was saying, well, how did I think it should be changed? And, yeah, just like you said, the people need help first. That's one thing. But let's shut off UFO abduction research. Just no more books, no more conferences, and take care and listen to people and take care of them, and don't shove any ideas about anything down their throat.
It'd honestly be better to not have a hotline for someone to call if they think they're abducted. You know, it's almost worse to have that than to have nothing. You know, at least then you have the random chance of going to a shrink who may or may, you know, but I should call Bud Hopkins. You know, but no, and even a therapist. You know, that is someone who, it reminds me, let's put it this way, of the satanic panic thing in the 80s and 90s. You know, everybody recalls under hypnosis being part of a satanic underground that everybody's a member of except for you and me. You know, somehow, you know, everybody in town except for you and me is a member of the satanic cult that's killing millions of people, and, you know, all of which came out, or most, you know, 99% of which came out via, you know, hypnosis and regression.
Yeah. There is an idea about pleasing the therapist and all that. It's a tough one, though, because on the one hand, you don't want to send them. The people shouldn't be going to people that are UFO researchers, abduction researchers. And on the other hand, what else are you going to send to somebody that's going to say you're nuts and, you know, this didn't happen. And, you know, that's their bias, you see.
Yeah, that's kind of the other thing is, well, then how do you make a list of people? Because if they're not really interested and invested, then they're probably skeptical, because partly of what ufology has done, right? You know?
Yeah.
So it's almost like you really can't say go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, because, well, of course, if, you know, your first thought is, well, there might be a UFO-related aspect. Well, yeah, like you say, you know, that almost like you have to make a UFO-friendly psychiatrist list, but then who's going to sign up people that think UFOs are abducting people from already?
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, why aren't there more Benjamin Simons around, you know? Because there can't be any more, really. It's really tough.
Yeah, I mean, nobody wants to hear that you don't know what the answer to something is. I mean, nobody's going to pay to hear us say that we don't know what the hell is going on, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to the doctor to make myself feel better, not to tell him, not to have him say, I have no idea what's going on with you, sorry.
Right. And sometimes even, I guess the argument would be that having a story, regardless of whether it's the right story or the truthful, or however, the objectively correct story, you know, is sometimes enough. And I guess that's what, like, Dr. Simon's feeling was about the, you know, whatever happened, you know, this has kind of alleviated their symptoms.
Yeah.
Of course, Barney still died like 5 years later from a heart attack, but, you know.
Right. Hey, Tim, we've got 2 minutes left. Do you want to tell people about your site, or is there anything else that I didn't bring up that you wanted to bring up?
I think we well covered it. You know, it's just, you know, in Jim's memory, I continue on, and, you know.
I think we all do.
Science, you know, I still, you know, still try to approach the weirdness that exists in reality, and you know, there are different ways to do it. I, you know, the people that are loudest are usually the ones that are doing the least. So but you know, open-minded inquiry with people that don't have something to gain by having something through. So, you know, some of the kind of basic ideas that we really just lose, you know, basic concepts of science and just even just ways to treat each other, you know, to not have your story needs to conform to my preconceived notion of what happens to people. You know, it's, you know, just a little more pause before sticking foot in mouth, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, I mean, I hope I do want to collaborate, like, over, you know, again, with things to the folks. You know, they have the archives, the Billable archives and stuff over at West Georgia. And, you know, they had us over. You know, like I said, we're working on a piece now to try to discuss this same thing we're talking about. You know, what is the field? what is the, you know, what do we mean by the field, and how, what should we call it, the field, when we decide what the field is, you know? So that's something that, you know, hopefully your reality sandwich is wanting to run, and the mojomachine.net is just where I put my in progress or miscellaneous, you know, links and ratings. So there's that.
All right, Tim.
And watch the skies.
Yeah, yeah. As Jim used to say. Thanks so much, Tim. And I'll talk to you soon. And I'll have this posted here in the next week or so. And thanks so much again.
Thank you, man. Take care.
All right, you too. All right, that was Tim Brigham, a degree in psychology and a heavy interest in the anomalous. And I've known him for quite a few years. And it's the first time we got to talk in detail on the air, so I appreciate that. Got to get out of here because at the show's coming in with Bob. I will be back next week. Ken Thomas will be here live in the studio, and you can call in for that. So thanks for listening, and see you soon.
Why does blood turn brown and dries, and why do the tears well up in your eyes? Why didn't I learn to ride my bike when it was warm and sunny outside? Why can't little kids tie their shoes, and why can't the white people play the blues? Why can't I fall in love with you? It must be because of the seasons, when the leaves are falling from the tree.